Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, April 6th, 2025. First, an opinion from Dana Milbank. Mr. Milbank is most known for his political columns, but this column is personal and filled with delight. This is the most adorable creature you might never see. The spotted salamander has been heralding the season's arrival for millions of years. Posted on March 12, 2025. I am standing on the edge of a woods in total darkness, shivering. My Gore-Tex jacket has proved to be no match for the soaking rain, which has now intensified, as has the nearby thunder. For a moment, I am questioning my decision to drive 2 hours through rush hour traffic on Interstate 66 to be here on a weeknight, slipping in mud on the edge of a murky pond. But I have come because this is the night the animal world announces the arrival of spring. "They're over here," calls the biologist in our group, Jennifer Service. I walk carefully in the direction of her headlamp, over rocks and tree roots. And then I see them, first one, then another, then dozens of them, crawling out from under the trees and toward the water. I pick one up and hold it in my hand. Its smooth skin is a purplish gray, and it is covered from head to tail in bright yellow dots, as if painted by a child. It sits calmly in my hand, peering back at me with big, curious eyes, its closed mouth forming a line that looks very much like a grin. "What? You were expecting Punxsutawney Phil?" The famed groundhog, 200 miles to the north, has heralded spring with an accuracy rate of 30%, worse than flipping a coin. If you really want to know when spring arrives, you'll need to ask the spotted salamanders. They've been doing it right for millions of years. They also happen to be the most adorable animal most people ever see. That's because they spend almost their entire lives underground, in burrows or under rocks, emerging only at night to feed. This changes abruptly on the night of the first warm rain of spring. The amphibian's idea of warm, about 50 degrees Fahrenheit, is significantly chillier than my own when spotted salamanders emerge en masse from the ground and migrate toward vernal pools, which are temporary ponds that dry up in summer. Usually it happens in late February. This year, because of the cold winter, it was the first week of March. If the weather is volatile, there might be a number of smaller migrations over time. But migrate they always do, and those humans who check the forecast carefully have an annual chance to see these beauties, which look more imaginary, Barney, E.T., than real. In fact, they share a genus with a cartoon character. Mexico's Ambystoma mexicanum, the feathery gilled salamander known as the axolotl, has been popularized by the computer game Minecraft and, though endangered in the wild, is a sought-after pet and plush doll. Happily, its spotted cousin, Ambystoma maculatum, lives in great abundance in its native range across much of the east coast of the United States. But you have to see them on the night of their spring migration. Otherwise, you'll only find them by chance if one is under a rock you overturn in the forest. In these chaotic days in the affairs of humans, there's something soothing about the dependability of the salamander's migration. The president is driving us into recession and trade wars. Elon Musk is recklessly sabotaging the federal government. They've both plowed over the constitutional safeguards we thought were in place. But our little spotted friends continued to do what they have done since they first appeared here, between 3 and 5 million years ago, making their annual crawl to the water to procreate. Migration, like the term warm, is a relative one with salamanders. Some birds migrate thousands of miles. spotted salamanders migrate a few hundred feet. They'll stay in the water for a mating season that lasts only a few days, then return to the woods. But what a few days it is! It's just a wild party, says Brian Gratwick, a scientist with the Smithsonian's National Zoo and Conservation Biology Institute, and one of the world's top experts on amphibians. Once underwater, the animals congregate in large groups and perform a kind of mating dance, an amphibious orgy dubbed the Liebesspiel, which is German for lovemaking. Males deposit fluffy white sperm packets, called spermatophores, on vegetation on the pond bottom. Then each competes for a female by nudging her with his snout in an attempt to get her to choose his spermatophore. The female, once she makes her choice, straddles the spermatophore and inserts it into her body. She eventually deposits large gelatinous egg masses containing as many as 250 eggs, often fertilized by multiple fathers. These hatch in a month or two, and the larvae, similar to tadpoles, metamorphose in another 2 to 4 months and are ready to leave the pool. The vast majority are eaten by predators or die because the pool has dried up. But the survivors can live 20 or more years, returning to the same pool to breed every year. Few in the Washington region are aware that we live in what Gatwick calls the world's biodiversity hotspot for salamanders. Appalachia is the world's capital of amphibian life, and Virginia is the capital of the capital. In one Virginia study, Gratwick found as many as 32,000 redback salamanders per hectare, which means that there was a greater combined biomass of these tiny critters in the region than of deer or birds. Among the dozens of species here are giant hellbender salamanders and Amphiuma salamanders that look like eels. The endangered Shenandoah salamander lives on just a few north-facing peaks in Shenandoah National Park. There are tiger salamanders, Jefferson salamanders, four-toed salamanders, and, of course, the spotted salamanders. Like most life on Earth, amphibians are in trouble. The global biodiversity crisis caused by habitat loss, climate change, pesticides, and the like is causing animal populations to shrink almost across the board, and many species are heading for extinction. A 2013 study by the U.S. Geological Survey found amphibians declining in this country at a nearly 4% annual rate. Not as bad as in some parts of the world, but still catastrophic over time, in large part because we've been draining the wetlands where they reproduce. The good news, it's so much easier to reverse the amphibians' decline than it is with most animal populations, and just about everybody can help. Just dig a hole in a spot where water pools. In your backyard, you can go with a shovel and dig a hole, and suddenly you've got an amphibian factory, Gratwick recommends. Anytime you create a fishless vernal pool like that, they'll find it and they'll breed in it. Toads, he says, will probably find your pool the first year it is dug, and over time you might see gray tree frogs, red-spotted newts, spring peepers, upland chorus frogs, wood frogs, and spotted salamanders. I dug a vernal pool on my farm, following Gratwick's instructions, a circle about 10 feet in diameter and no more than 2 feet deep. As with most of my first attempts at projects on the farm, it failed. The rainwater quickly drained out of it, a problem that could have been avoided if I had put down a pond liner. My second attempt looks more promising. A guy with a backhoe helped me restore an old cattle pond on the property, deepening it and repairing the dam. The pond is spring-fed and will probably have some water in it year-round, which will invite bullfrogs and green frogs and may deter other amphibians. But it's all good. Just a few nights after we restored the pond, I could already hear the spring peepers. My friend Nick Lapham is, as usual, way ahead of me. The owner of Sunnyside Farm and Conservancy outside Washington, Virginia, dug out an old cattle watering hole and lined it to make a 25-foot-wide vernal pool in the summer of 2023, one of a few on his farm. This was the one I visited just 18 months later on the night of the spotted salamander migration. It was exploding with amphibian life. The high-pitched whistles from the spring peepers, the inch-long critters' vocal sacs inflate to amplify their calls, were so loud that I had to cover my ears at times. In harmony, hundreds of wood frogs were calling, making a lower-pitched sound more like hens clucking or ducks quacking. In the pool, the frogs were chasing, tangling, and whirling with each other in various stages of procreation. "This is nuts!" Lapham shouted above the din as he stuck his GoPro camera into the pool. Then Service, Sunnyside's conservation director, and her husband, Ed Myers, a herpetologist, found the salamanders. Once I knew where they were coming from, I could watch with my headlamp their slow-motion purple parade as they crept from behind rocks and trees and toward the water, which they can apparently smell. Once in the pool, they were far more dexterous, swimming as though they had spent their lives there. They busily circled each other at the bottom of the pool, occasionally swimming to the surface for a quick gulp of air, and then returning to their business. In another, less murky pond nearby, we could see the results of their labors, the white spermatophores on the bottom of the pool, and the improbably large egg sacs stretching from branches in the pond. As I watched these animals nearing the end of their painfully slow migration, I fought the urge to pick each one up and help it over the last few yards and into the pond. They didn't need my help. Lapham had already given them everything they needed by rebuilding a small piece of the habitat that has sustained the spotted salamander for millions of years. Nature would take care of the rest. Dana Milbank is a nationally syndicated op-ed columnist for The Washington Post. He also provides political commentary for various TV outlets, and he is the author of 5 books on politics, including the New York Times bestseller, The Destructionists, and the national bestseller, Homo Politicus. He is also a huge fan of the spotted salamander. This column was posted in the Washington Post on March 12, 2025. Next, we turn to the March 2025 issue of Science News, an article written by Jenny Crumrine. She is a freelance writer, and her kids are obsessed with puffins. So when her brother mentioned a puffling rescue operation in Iceland, she was all in. For her photo essay about the puffling patrol, she traveled to an island off the coast of Iceland. There are at least 3 pronunciations of this island: Heimaey, Heimaey, and Heimaey. For this article, I'm going to use the pronunciation Heimaey. The freelance writer Jenny Crumrine was impressed by the people's devotion. Some nights, near-freezing wind scoured the island, making it hard to walk, yet lots of people were out searching for pufflings for hours, she said. Her article, Patrolling for Puffins, A Community in Iceland Helps Wayward Birds Find the Sea, and Helps Scientists, Too. A small rocky island off Iceland is home to the world's largest breeding colony of Atlantic puffins. When breeding season is in full swing, around 1.5 million adults pair up and nestle into burrows on the grassy seaside slopes above Heimaey islands, rocky cliffs. Once chicks hatch, puffin moms and dads devote about 6 weeks to caring for their babies, bringing meals of small fish and fending off predators such as seagulls. By late August or early September, the pufflings are mature enough to live on their own. Over 4 to 5 weeks, throngs of young birds head off to sea. Their instinct is to head for the open ocean, where they will spend most of their lives. They leave in the dark of night to hide from predators, guided by the moon. But sometimes fledglings lose their way. Haimea's only town got electricity about a century ago. Ever since, dazzled by night lights or swept along in stiff sea breezes, some young puffins have taken a wrong turn toward town. Light pollution affects wildlife in perilous ways, disrupting crucial activities from pollination to mating. Some creatures, like these Atlantic puffins, lose their orientation and can't find their way to the ocean. Some could be attacked by predators. Others might starve. Fortunately for these pufflings, the residents of Haimea have taken a hands-on approach to addressing the problem. The community-based Puffling Patrol searches for and rescues birds that have gone astray. These chicks and colony adults are helping scientists study puffins' largely mysterious lives at sea. Parents care for immature pufflings until they can fly off on their own. The downy fluff around this puffling's neck that is shown in a photo shows that it's not yet ready to fledge. Pufflings leave the burrow under the cover of night and head to the sea, but artificial light can disorient them. To the rescue. Equipped with flashlights, cardboard boxes, and gloves, folks head out after dark searching for lost chicks. They scour backyards, parking lots, and rooftops, and gas stations, wherever the bright glow of town competes with moonlight. On any given night during puffling season, a dozen or more small groups and individuals may be patrolling the town. Rescuing stranded birds is a long-standing tradition on this island, though the catchy Puffling Patrol name has been around for only a decade or so. Typically, teens or younger kids scour the night alongside parents or grandparents who pass down the tradition. For the little ones, it's a great excuse to stay up late. Puffins dive from the sea surface to nab food. They zip through the water as if they're flying, but adaptations that enhance swimming, such as a stubby wingspan, come at the expense of takeoff ability, which leaves them vulnerable to cats and other predators on land. On the upside, the birds are easy to catch. Usually it takes just a short chase to grab one. The bird is put in a cardboard box and taken home. People are asked to weigh their rescued pufflings and log them on the Puffling Patrol website. The only thing to watch out for are the pufflings' tiny kitten-like claws. The patrol often takes healthy rescues, those large enough to live at sea, to the cliffs. From this height, the birds can catch some air. They'll fly as far as they're able before landing in the water, perhaps 50 meters or more. The farther, the better. Some pufflings need a helpful boost, a push, off the clifftop, while others take the initiative on their own. And we see one member of the Puffling Patrol with a beautiful ocean just out of reach as she stands on the cliff and releases a puffling. Some rescues, however, need extra care. While wandering around town, pufflings sometimes fall into the harbor and end up slick with oil from the local passenger ferry, from cargo ships, and from fishing boats. Dirtied feathers must be cleaned to become waterproof again. Otherwise, the birds would not survive in the frigid North Atlantic. Other pufflings may be injured or underfed, and some may have left home too early, before growing their adult plumage. These birds are taken to the Puffin Rescue Center in Haimea, run by the global nonprofit Sea Life Trust. There's even a drop box for after-hour arrivals, where pufflings will remain safe through the night. During the 2024 season, the Puffling Patrol rescued more than 4,200 pufflings. That's approximately one bird for every human on Haimea. Life at sea. For about 420 of the rescued birds, scientists put a ring on the puffin's legs. It's an ID band, allowing researchers to document a bird's location each time it's sighted and to monitor their population. Adult puffins develop a brightly colored striped beak and orange feet. This adult appearance does not change much, aside from the beak color getting brighter during breeding season. So the only way to know a puffin's exact age by sight is if it's been tagged. With the rings, scientists have learned puffins can live at least 40 years. The birds spend most of their lives in the open ocean. Observing birds at sea is nearly impossible, so much about puffins remains a mystery. Ecologists like Erpur Snare Hansen, who leads a team at the South Island Nature Research Center, are curious to know how far puffins roam and where they go. Each June, Hansen and colleagues briefly capture adults at their burrows, while also checking on eggs, and fit them with battery-operated global location sensors. These geolocators detect changes in daylight, which can be analyzed to pinpoint a bird's location within about 180 kilometers. On Haimea, only adult birds are currently tagged with these GLS devices, but other researchers in Scandinavia have begun tracking juveniles as well to learn about their movements after fledging. For about a decade, Hansen and other researchers have contributed GLS data to SeaTrack, a project that tracks seabirds. The data are revealing what seabirds do offshore, why there are fewer and fewer of them, and what humans can do to help them survive. In Europe, where more than 90% of Atlantic puffins reside, the species is listed as endangered. The European population of about 7.8 million birds is projected to decrease by 50 to 79% between 2000 and 2065, within three puffin generations. Puffins face a variety of threats. One of their main food sources is sand eels, a group of slender fish with an eel-like appearance. Sand eel populations are shrinking due to climate change and industrial-scale overfishing. Puffins must compete with other sea life and trawlers for dwindling numbers of these and other forage fish. When sand eels become scarce, puffins must work harder to find them. Puffins stressed this way often produce fewer chicks. Another threat is pollution, including mercury, plastics, and contaminants from shipping. Bird migration studies using SeaTrack data have identified sites in the North Atlantic where restricting human activity and prioritizing pollution cleanup efforts could have a big impact. For instance, there's a vital feeding ground for about 5 million seabirds, including puffins and 20 other species, in the middle of the Atlantic. Species from at least 56 colonies, spanning 16 countries and regions, come to this area during the vulnerable molting period, when birds shed worn-out feathers. In 2021, a European consortium called the OSPAR, O-S-P-A-R, Convention, declared this spot a marine protected area, the North Atlantic Current and Evlonoff Seamount. It's the first such area identified by tracking data. Waiting for a homecoming. Once puffling season ends and burrows empty out, Haimea's seaside cliffs go quiet. Members of the Puffling Patrol catch up on lost sleep and share their favorite picks. At the end of the 2024 puffling season, three rescues couldn't be released and now live in an enclosure at the Puffin Rescue Center, where visitors can watch their antics. Meanwhile, Iceland's puffin researchers wait patiently for the bird's summer return. Adult puffins return to the same colony, even the same burrow, year after year. With the data collected from these birds, Hansen and other scientists will weave together the story of each wanderer's ocean journey. And we see a puffin in flight. The range of Atlantic puffins spans the North Atlantic from the coasts of Canada and the northeastern United States to Greenland and Russia. The birds spend most of their time at sea, returning to land only during breeding season. And in several other pictures, first we see a bird in a cardboard box. When members of the Puffling Patrol discover a wayward bird, they put it in a cardboard box to bring home, and then we see that they get weighed. Birds that are healthy enough will be brought back to Haumea's seaside cliffs for release. One of the staff members at the Puffin Rescue Center gives one puffling a boost toward the sea as she releases it from a cliff. And as this article mentioned, to help monitor the puffin population, various researchers will put an ID ring on a rescued puffling's leg. In the photo, we see research assistant Lucas Canas Hernandez putting the ring on the puffling as he has it caught between his legs inside a tube. In the future, if scientists come across the bird again, they'll know how old it is because they know when they attached the ID ring. And this article on the Puffling Patrol in Haumea, an island off the coast of Greenland, was written by freelance writer Jenny Crumrine. As we noted, her kids are obsessed with puffins, but we find out that she is as well. The following articles were previously broadcast on shows last fall, 2024. Democracy in Decline: How Political Scientists Measure the Health of a Republic. The October 19, 2024 issue of Science News. Many Americans are worried about democratic erosion, so Science News asked political scientists about the state of the U.S. Republic and how they measure threats to democracy. By Sujata Gupta. State of Democracy. Is U.S. democracy in decline? Here's how political scientists are investigating. The United States' reputation as an exemplar of democracy appears to be eroding. In a poll taken earlier this year, 2024, almost three-quarters of U.S. respondents agreed that the country's democracy used to be a good example for other countries to follow, but has not been in recent years. People elsewhere appear to share that sentiment. The majority of poll respondents in Canada, the United Kingdom, Germany, Japan, and South Korea also agreed with the statement. More than 60% of U.S. respondents in another poll from December 2023 believe that democracy in America is at risk depending on who wins the upcoming presidential election. Obviously, this article was written before the election results. Republican respondents see Democratic candidates as threatening the system and vice versa. Now voters face the looming specter of the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol, in which supporters of former President Donald Trump, now president-elect, attempted to halt the certification of the 2020 election. Echoes of that event have many questioning whether this year's election will be free, fair, and result in a peaceful transition of power. A prominent metric that political scientists look to, called Varieties of Democracy, or VDEM, which hinges on the notion of free and fair elections, shows a slight dip in the health of U.S. democracy over the last decade. Political scientists using that tool disagree over how to interpret that decline. Yet catching democratic erosion early is key to riding the course, says political scientist Rachel Beatty Riedel of Cornell University. It's really important to pay attention to those tiny dips. To understand the state of U.S. democracy, Science News went to experts with these five questions. How do political scientists define and measure democracy? How do you measure changes in democratic systems? How troubling is the dip in the U.S. democracy score? What factors play a role in destabilizing democracy? And what helps keep democracy strong? Question number one, how do political scientists define and measure democracy? Political scientists have long debated whether democracy is a matter of kind, a country is either a democracy or not, or a matter of degree. Some 30 years ago, political scientist Adam Przeworski of New York University argued democracy exists when an incumbent government peacefully cedes power to the winning party following a loss at the polls. Democracy is a system in which sitting governments lose elections, Przeworski says. The simplicity of this binary definition allows for ease of measurement, as elections and their aftermath are readily observable. And this litmus test has endured. It actually works well most of the time, says Daniel Pimstein, a political scientist at North Dakota State University in Fargo. But Przeworski's test has limitations. Even when he introduced his measure in the 1990s, he had trouble classifying some countries. Botswana, for instance. Botswana was, and still is, a country in which there's relative freedom, freedom of the press, freedom of the unions. There are regular elections. Elections are never questioned by any observers, and yet the same party always wins, he says. So there was no way for us to tell what would happen if they lose. Would they accept the defeat, or would they not accept the defeat? Today, Przeworski's measure shows that such hard-to-classify countries are increasing in number, which he suspects is due to a global trend away from democracy. But, he acknowledges, such small shifts are hard to capture with a binary measure. Question 2. How do you measure changes in democratic systems? Many political scientists rely on metrics that treat democracy as existing along a continuum. The VDEM project allows researchers and policymakers to evaluate a country's system of governance along several dimensions, including level of inequality, whether citizens feel heard, and the presence and strength of systems of checks and balances. All those measures build from electoral democracy, says Michael Coppedge of the University of Notre Dame in Indiana and a principal investigator for the project. VDEM's Electoral Democracy Index focuses on the election period, including free and fair elections and other conditions surrounding the event, such as freedom of the press, respect for civil liberties, the right to organize, and broad suffrage. The more stringent and widely used VDEM index of liberal democracy includes those factors and adds a close look at the years between elections, particularly a country's system of checks and balances. The system used by VDEM to measure the health of democracy involves some subjectivity. Political scientists in countries around the world provide ratings for questions about governance, such as those pertaining to election violence and interference, executive respect for the Constitution, and impartiality among public officials. Their responses range from 0 for the worst behavior and up to 5 for the best. VDEM researchers then take those responses to calculate scores ranging from 0 to 1, most democratic, for each index it tracks, including electoral and liberal democracy. The political scientists don't have to explain the rationale behind each rating, but analysts can look at which scores in the questionnaire have fluctuated over time to get a sense of their thought process, Coppedge says. Our data is very good for tracking changes within countries over time. In the United States, the liberal democracy score has been on a marked upward trend since 1900, the first year in the index. But scores have recently dipped from 0.85 in 2015 to 0.77 in 2023. The decline in scores is linked to survey responses related to violence around the time of elections, perceptions that opposition parties cannot exercise oversight over the ruling party, and weakened checks and balances. Coppedge cites several events over the last few years that could help explain what the expert raters were thinking, including efforts in some states to prevent felons from voting, even after they have completed their sentences, and partisan efforts to block Supreme Court nominees. Many political scientists view the violent events of January 6, 2021, as particularly troubling. On that day, Trump supporters who refused to accept President Joe Biden's November victory stormed to the Capitol to try to overturn the election results. That's a pretty obvious effort to subvert democracy, Coppedge says. Question number three. How troubling is the dip in the U.S. democracy score? The U.S. score on liberal democracy remains on par with countries like the United Kingdom, which also scored 0.77 in 2023, and Canada, which scored 0.76. But researchers such as Riedel say that even small dips in scores warrant serious attention because pinpointing precisely when a country begins shifting toward autocracy is challenging, yet key to thwarting further backsliding. And the U.S. dip is part of a larger global shift toward autocracy over the last decade, VDEM researchers claimed in their 2024 annual report. More than 70% of the world's population, or 5.7 billion people, lived in autocracies in 2023, compared with 50% in 2003, the team found. Baseline electoral democracy scores provide further evidence of a global decline in democracy. In 2003, 11 countries were in the process of autocratizing. In 2023, that number nearly quadrupled to 42. But some researchers question these findings. Earlier this year, a pair of political scientists found there is no global backsliding trend. Andrew Little of the University of California, Berkeley, and Anne Meng of the University of Virginia in Charlottesville quantified purportedly objective measures of democracy versus the more subjective VDEM index, including Przeworski's measure of incumbent losses at the polls, as well as executive constraints and attacks on the press. There are over 200 countries in the world, and at any given time, some of them, such as Hungary and Venezuela today, will be undergoing democratic backsliding. But that does not make a trend, Meng and Little wrote in April in PS, Political Science and Politics. The common claim that we are in a period of massive global democratic decline is not clearly supported by empirical evidence. Meng and Little refrain from commenting on whether the United States is in a period of democratic decline, but they speculate that intensive media coverage of the supposed decline could be biasing the judgment of experts, such as VDEM's raters. But Coppedge and his team say that they have found little to no evidence of such bias. Regardless of how one calculates or interprets global trends, the odds of the United States turning into an autocracy are extremely low, political scientist Daniel Treisman of UCLA argued in 2023 in the journal Comparative Political Studies. VDEM data suggests that both wealth and duration protect a democratic country from reverting to autocracy. No democracy in the data set that has survived for over 43 years has ever failed, Treisman notes. Treisman's work builds on political scientists' longstanding observation that capitalism and the wealth such a system generates is linked to democracy. But trends over the last few decades suggest that the link might be weakening. Riedel and colleagues argued in a 2023 preprint in the journal World Politics. Treisman didn't include countries that have democratized over the last several decades, and he took a narrow approach to understanding the process of autocratization, Riedel says. Treisman and others tend to focus on full regime change, democratic death, which is indeed very rare. Subtler measures that look at the weakening of democratic systems paint a more nuanced picture. Riedel's team analyzed more than 100 episodes of democratic erosion across all countries in the VDEM dataset since 1990. 38 of the 202 countries in the dataset experienced statistically significant reductions in democracy scores. Roughly half of those countries exceeded wealth levels thought to protect against such erosion. What factors play a role in destabilizing democracy? Political scientists have typically focused on forces that stabilize democracies in capitalist societies, such as wealth, education, and labor, Riedel says. But they have paid less attention to capitalism's destabilizing forces, chiefly endemic inequality. That inequality, coupled with polarization, both a cause and effect of backsliding, helps promote populist leaders promising to make the system work for everyday people, regardless of whether the proposed solutions adhere to democratic principles. Such populist leaders may come to power through legitimate elections, but then pursue autocratic agendas by weakening systems of checks and balances. For instance, Hungary appeared to be a stable democracy during the 1990s and 2000s, with liberal democracy scores above 0.7. Those scores began plummeting when Viktor Orban became prime minister in 2010, dropping to just over 0.3 by 2023. Orban has spent years chipping away at the court's independence, seeking to put the judicial system under control of the ruling party, packing the courts with partisan judges, and extending judicial term limits. Seeking to put the judicial system under control of the ruling party. Changing the composition of the courts is a really significant pathway to authoritarianism, Riedel says. In the United States, four factors could trigger democratic backsliding, political scientist Suzanne Mettler of Cornell University and Robert Lieberman of Johns Hopkins University wrote in March 2024 in the journal Annals of the American Academy of Political and Social Science. Those factors are polarization, conflicts over belonging, economic inequality, and executive aggrandizement. The January 2021 insurrection, in which all four factors converged for the first time in U.S. history, was a particularly troubling threat because it violates Przeworski's basic tenet of peaceful transition of power as core to democracy, Mettler says. You have to accept the outcome and let the winner govern, and if you get away from that, you just do not have democracy. Question number five. What helps keep democracy strong? Finding and utilizing points of resilience, such as the courts, legislatures, or a vibrant independent press, are key to strengthening democracy, according to experts. In Brazil, for instance, the courts determined that former President Jair Bolsonaro had abused his power when he claimed, without evidence, that the country's election system was rigged ahead of his 2022 loss to Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. In June 2023, justices blocked Bolsonaro from seeking re-election until 2030. Even when voters believe checks and balances are weak, their voices, coupled with a robust media, can ward off threats, Riedel says. In 2023, she co-authored 15 in-depth case studies of countries showing signs of autocratization for the U.S. Agency for International Development. South Korea, for instance, shows the need for constant vigilance. The country recovered from an autocratic turn in the last decade, but continues to oscillate between democratic regression and recovery, according to the VDEM project. The country's score went from 0.6 in 2014 to 0.8 a few years later, due in part to intense media exposure and coverage of then-President Park Geun-hye's central role in a massive corruption scandal. That reporting triggered months-long candlelight rallies demanding Park's impeachment. The country's independent National Assembly impeached Park in December 2016. In March 2017, the courts upheld the impeachment and forced Park out of office. Recent reports, though, show that the country's scores are now back in the 0.6 range due to the current administration's punishment of members of the previous presidential administration. The United States has strong points of democratic resilience, Kopich says. That includes powerful, independent media outlets and civic society organizations, intense competition between political parties, and public engagement at all levels in the process, whether it's learning about candidates' positions, supporting candidates through actions like canvassing and phone banking, and most essential, voting. Institutions and government leaders, Riedel says, can be empowered to be agents of democracy when they are given that push from below. And a summary of democracy under fire. Four types of threats: polarization, conflict over who belongs, economic inequality, and executive aggrandizement, presidential overreach, have endangered U.S. democracy at various points in the country's history, according to political scientists Suzanne Mettler of Cornell University and Robert Lieberman of Johns Hopkins University. Here's a look at the country's past brushes with authoritarianism, which Mettler and Lieberman describe in their 2020 book, Four Threats. In the 1790s, the threat was polarization. In the country's infancy, members of the ruling Federalist Party, most notably John Adams and Alexander Hamilton, abhorred the opposing Democratic-Republican Party. The passage of the 1798 Sedition Act made it a crime to publish material critical of the government, a move that Democratic Republicans, including Thomas Jefferson, saw as blatantly authoritarian. Violence seemed imminent after the 1800 presidential election failed to produce a clear victor. But members of the House of Representatives selected Jefferson as the winner, and the country established the tradition of a peaceful transfer of power between parties. In the 1850s, the threat, polarization, conflict over who belongs, and rising economic inequality. The triple threat of political polarization, mounting tensions over slavery, and the status of black people in the U.S., and economic inequality brought on in part by the Industrial Revolution, jeopardized U.S. democracy. The Founding Fathers set that fight into motion with the Three-Fifths Compromise, which counted three out of every five enslaved people toward a state's population and boosted slaveholding states' clout in the House of Representatives and Electoral College. When Kansas sought to become a state in the mid-1850s, violent conflicts broke out between the country's pro- and anti-slavery factions. Those tensions ultimately triggered the Civil War. In the 1890s, the threat, polarization, conflict over who belongs, and rising economic inequality. The same threats that were present 40 years before in the 1850s. After the Civil War, authoritarian enclaves spread across the South as states imposed poll taxes and literacy tests to disenfranchise black Americans and poor white people. In the 1930s, the threat was executive aggrandizement. In an effort to lift the country out of the Great Depressions and prevent a repeat, President Franklin Roosevelt pushed for reform and regulations that gave the executive branch unprecedented control over banks and the stock market. During World War II, he expanded his office's ability to spy on everyday Americans. And in the 1970s, the threat was also executive aggrandizement. The growth of the executive branch during the Cold War emboldened President Richard Nixon to heighten surveillance of Americans critical of the Vietnam War, as well as members of the Democratic Party. That includes a botched wiretapping of Democratic National Committee headquarters in what became known as the Watergate scandal. Journalists, judges, and members of Congress reined in Nixon, who resigned after facing impeachment. And this cover feature, State of Democracy, poses five questions to answer the big question, is U.S. democracy in decline? The article was written by Sujata Gupta and was published in the October 19, 2024 issue of Science News in the Department of Social Science. Did you hear the one about the penguin that swam to Australia? If not, we'll turn to the New York Times, published on November 7, 2024. After a 2,000-mile trip, a penguin finds itself on an Australian beach. This is the furthest north I've heard of an emperor penguin, an expert said. The article is written by Victor Mather. It was a day as Australian as you can get. Sun, waves, and surfing at the beach. And then something distinctly un-Australian turned up. Aaron Fowler and a friend were heading back to the parking lot after a day in the waves. We saw something coming out of the water, Mr. Fowler, a 37-year-old drywall repairman, said. We thought it was a seabird, but then we thought, oh, that's way too big. And it had a big, long neck and tail sticking out like a duck. It stood up in the water and waddled straight up to us and just started cleaning itself. Standing there on the beach in the small town of Denmark in Western Australia on Friday afternoon was a male emperor penguin, about 2,100 miles from where one might expect to find it, in Antarctica. Mr. Fowler had seen plenty of dolphins and other creatures in the waves, including one leopard seal, which is also native to Antarctica, but he never expected a penguin. We were in shock, he said. Even someone with years of experience studying penguins was surprised at the sighting. That crazy young penguin, said Dee Bersma, a professor of biology at the University of Washington and author of Penguins, Natural History and Conservation. Emperor penguins move around because they have to be on an ice sheet or a glacier to raise young, and the glaciers are eroding away, she said. That's not unusual. You've got to continue to swim until you find food. But this is the furthest north I've heard of an emperor penguin. Record low sea ice levels in the Antarctic have wreaked havoc on the lives of emperor penguins. Penguins have sought new breeding grounds as a result, but normally they stay relatively close to their old homes. This penguin's motivation for the much longer trip was almost certainly food, Dr. Bersma said, especially as it was an emperor, the largest penguin species with the biggest appetite. You may be a young bird without much food, so you're going to look elsewhere, Dr. Bersma said. You've got to continue to swim until you find food. Moving around is common among penguins, though normally over much shorter distances. Young penguins have to explore their world, Dr. Bersma said. The penguin who arrived in Australia did not seem to have been flummoxed too much by its new surroundings, even when finding itself on a beach with surfers instead of sea ice. The penguin seemed completely happy, Mr. Fowler said. It was not at all shy. It was very friendly. It was quite happy in our company. Dr. Bersma said, I think he was just looking for a place to land. It doesn't matter. You like to rest a little. She added, as long as he's in a place with a lot of food, he'll be fine. While this may be the longest known journey under a penguin's own power, Dr. Bersma knows of a longer trip, with an asterisk. She noted that a Humboldt penguin had been found in Alaska, despite penguins normally being found exclusively in the southern hemisphere. That penguin hitched a ride, probably on a tuna boat, she said. You can't come into a port with a penguin, so they probably threw it overboard. But don't fear for the penguin in Alaska either. It was doing fine living on herring, Dr. Bersma said. Mr. Fowler alerted the authorities about the newly immigrated Aussie penguin. It was picked up and is being cared for. Its rehabilitation is expected to take a few weeks. The Department of Biodiversity, Conservation, and Attractions of Western Australia said. The penguin appeared to be malnourished, the agency said, and was removed from the beach to avoid potential threats from dogs, cats, foxes, and vehicles. I have a dedicated penguin enclosure, said Carol Bidulph, a wildlife carer with the agency. Of course, I've never had to deal with a large penguin like this before. They've always been a lot smaller, our local little penguins. Never in my wildest thoughts would I have thought I'd ever have an emperor penguin to care for. It's just amazing. While the penguin may be settling into life down under, on the beach it soon discovered that sand and ice are two different things. He did a little belly slide on the sand. I think he thought it was snow, Mr. Fowler said. He didn't get far. He had a bit of a tumble. The author of this article, Victor Mather, has been a reporter and editor at the Times for 25 years, covering sports and breaking news. This article, after a 2,000-mile trip, a penguin finds itself on an Australian beach, was posted in the New York Times Online on November 7, 2024. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.